and he would have done this without delay, had not his father and his brother gone out to meet him and checked his impulse, urging him to measure his vengeance by threat and menace alone, and to spare the king, through whom he had risen to such power. He ought, they said, if he had been provoked by being summoned to trial, at least to give thanks for his acquittal, and not meet harshness with harshness while being ungrateful for his deliverance. And if one must reckon that the outcomes of war are decided by God, then the injustice lay more heavily on the side of the campaign, since he was about to engage a king who was also his foster companion, and often his benefactor, never harsh toward him except insofar as, swayed by wicked advisers, he had cast a shadow of wrongdoing over him. Herod was persuaded by this, judging that it was enough for his future hopes to have simply displayed his strength to the nation. Meanwhile, there arose around Apamea a Roman disturbance and civil war. Caecilius Bestius, out of loyalty to Pompey, treacherously murdered Sextus Caesar and took over his forces, while Caesar's other generals gathered an army to avenge the murder. To these men, both because of the one killed and because of the one still living, both being his friends, Antipater, through his sons, sent military support. As the war dragged on, Mercus arrived from Italy as Sextus's successor. And at this same time, there broke out among the Romans the great war of Cassius and Brutus, who had treacherously killed Caesar after he had held power for 3 years and 7 months. After the enormous upheaval caused by this murder, and with the leading men split into factions, each moved according to his own hopes toward whatever he judged to his advantage. And so Cassius came into Syria to take over the forces around Apamea. There he reconciled Bestius and Mercus and their divided legions, freed Apamea from siege, and then, taking command of the army himself, went about the cities levying tribute and exacting payments beyond their capacity. When the Jews too were ordered to contribute 700 talents, Antipater, fearing Cassius's threats, divided the task of collecting the money quickly among his sons and certain other associates, among them a certain Malichus, one of his rivals, so pressing was the necessity. Herod was the first to placate Cassius, bringing in 100 talents from his own share in Galilee, and for this he was counted among his closest friends. The rest Cassius reviled for their slowness and vented his anger on their cities. Gophna and Emmaus and 2 other, lesser towns he reduced to slavery, and he was on his way to put Malichus to death as well, for not having collected his share promptly, when Antipater averted his ruin, and that of the other cities, by quickly winning over Cassius with 100 talents. Malichus, however, once Cassius had withdrawn, did not repay Antipater's kindness with gratitude, but instead began plotting against the very man who had so often saved him, eager to remove the obstacle to his own crimes. Antipater, fearing the man's power and cunning, crossed the Jordan to gather an army in defense against the plot. But Malichus, though found out, got the better of Antipater's sons through sheer shamelessness. By many protestations and oaths, he beguiled both Phasael, the guardian of Jerusalem, and Herod, who held command of the forces, into becoming intermediaries for him with their father. So that once again he was saved through Antipater's intervention, who persuaded Mercus, then governor of Syria, who had been intent on putting Malichus to death for his rebellious conduct. When war broke out against Cassius and Brutus on the part of the young Caesar and Antony, Cassius and Mercus, gathering an army out of Syria, and since Herod seemed to contribute a great deal to their needs, appointed him at that time overseer of all Syria, giving him both infantry and cavalry. And Cassius promised that after the war was settled, he would make him king of Judea as well. But it turned out that the very strength of his son and this hope became the cause of Antipater's destruction. For fearing these things, Malichus bribed one of the royal cupbearers with money to give Antipater poison. And so, having become the victim of Malichus's crime, he died after a banquet. A man in other respects vigorous in the conduct of affairs, and one who had both recovered the throne for Hyrcanus and preserved it for him. Malichus, suspected of the poisoning, denied it and won over the angry populace, and made himself still more powerful by mustering men-at-arms. For he supposed that Herod would not remain quiet, and indeed Herod at once appeared, leading an army to avenge his father. But when his brother Phasael advised him not to move openly against the man, lest the populace be thrown into factional strife, for the moment Herod received Malichus when he came to defend himself, and professed to absolve him of suspicion while conducting a splendid funeral procession for his father. Turning then to Samaria, which was in the grip of civil strife, he restored order to the city. Then, at the time of a festival, he returned to Jerusalem leading his troops. And when Hyrcanus sent word, for Malichus, in his fear of Herod's approach, urged him to do so, forbidding foreign troops to be brought in among the ritually purified native population, Herod disregarded both the pretext and the one giving the order and entered by night. And again Malichus, coming to him, wept over Antipater. Herod, with difficulty, pretended in return, restraining his anger, and in letters to Cassius, who hated Malichus in any case, he lamented his father's murder. Cassius, writing back, ordered him to avenge his father's murderer, and secretly instructed the tribunes under his own command to assist Herod in this just act. And when, after Herod had taken Laodicea, the powerful men from every quarter gathered bringing gifts and crowns, Herod set aside this occasion for his vengeance. Malichus, growing suspicious, as this took place at Tyre, resolved secretly to withdraw his son, who was being held hostage among the Tyrians, and made ready to flee himself into Judea. And it was his despair of safety that spurred him to this plan, and forced King Antiochus to surrender Samosata. Meanwhile, Herod's affairs in Judea were falling apart. He had left his brother Joseph in charge of everything, with orders to attempt nothing against Antigonus until his own return, since Machaerus had not proved a reliable ally, to judge from what he had done. But when Joseph heard that his brother was far away, he ignored those orders and marched on Jericho with 5 cohorts that Machaerus had sent along with him, meaning to seize the grain at the height of the harvest. The enemy attacked him in the mountains and difficult terrain. He himself died, showing great courage in the battle, and the whole Roman force was destroyed, for the cohorts were newly levied from Syria and had no admixture of the so-called veteran soldiers able to support men inexperienced in war. Antigonus was not satisfied with the victory. He carried his rage so far as to abuse Joseph's corpse. Once he held the bodies, he cut off his head, even though Pheroras, Joseph's brother, offered 50 talents as ransom for it. After Antigonus's victory, affairs in Galilee were thrown into such turmoil that his partisans there seized the leading men who favored Herod and drowned them in the lake. Much of Idumea also changed sides, where Machaerus was fortifying one of the strongholds, called Gitta. Herod had not yet learned of any of this. After the fall of Samosata, Antony placed Sosius in charge of Syria and ordered him to support Herod against Antigonus, then withdrew himself to Egypt. Sosius sent 2 legions ahead into Judea to assist Herod and followed close behind with the rest of his force. While Herod was at Daphne, near Antioch, clear dreams foretold his brother's death, and as he leapt from his bed in distress, messengers brought news of the disaster. He mourned the loss only briefly, put off the greater part of his grief, and pressed on against the enemy, marching beyond what his strength allowed. Reaching Lebanon, he gathered 800 men from around the mountain as allies, and 1 Roman legion joined him there. With these forces, without waiting even a single day, he invaded Galilee and drove the enemy, who had come out to meet him, back to the position they had abandoned earlier. He kept attacking the fort without pause, but before he could take it, a violent storm forced him to encamp in the nearby villages. When, a few days later, the 2nd legion arrived from Antony and joined him, the enemy, fearing his strength, abandoned the stronghold during the night. From there he pressed on through Jericho, hurrying to hunt down his brother's killers as quickly as possible. There a strange, providential thing happened to him, from which, saved against all expectation, he won a reputation as a man especially beloved by God. Many of the leading men had dined with him that evening, and once the banquet broke up and everyone had left, the house immediately collapsed. Reading this as a common sign of both the dangers and the deliverance awaiting him in the coming war, he set his army moving at dawn. About 6,000 of the enemy came running down from the mountains and tested his front ranks, not daring to close with the Romans hand to hand but hurling stones and javelins from a distance, wounding many. In this skirmish, Herod himself, riding past, was struck in the side by a javelin. Wanting to prevail not only through his men's daring but also through sheer numbers, Antigonus sent a certain Pappus, one of his companions, with an army around to Samaria. Pappus's task, then, was to deal with Machaerus. While Herod overran the enemy's territory, destroyed 5 small towns, killed 2,000 of their inhabitants, burned the houses, and returned to camp, quartered near the village called Cana. Each day a great crowd of Jews joined him, from Jericho itself, and from the rest of the country, some driven by hatred of Antigonus, others stirred by Herod's successes, though most were moved simply by an irrational hunger for change. Herod hurried to give battle, and Pappus's men, undaunted by either the numbers or the momentum against them, went out eagerly to meet him. When the fighting began, the rest of the enemy's forces held out only briefly. But Herod, risking himself in memory of his murdered brother and determined to punish those responsible for the killing, quickly overpowered the men before him, then turned again and again against whatever body still held together, pursuing them all. The slaughter was immense. Some were driven back into the village they had set out from, while Herod pressed the rearmost and killed without number. He burst in among the enemy inside the village itself. Every house was packed with armed men, and the rooftops above were crowded with defenders. Once he had mastered those outside, he tore apart the dwellings and dragged out those hiding within, bringing the roofs down on many at once and destroying them in heaps, while the soldiers met with drawn swords those who scrambled out of the wreckage. So great a heap of corpses piled up that it blocked the roads for the victors. The enemy could not bear this blow. What remained of their gathered force, once it saw those throughout the village destroyed, scattered in flight, and Herod, at once emboldened by the victory, would have marched straight on Jerusalem had a most violent storm not held him back. This delay proved an obstacle both to his complete triumph and, for Antigonus, to his ruin, since it left him weighing whether to abandon the city already. Toward evening, Herod sent his exhausted friends off to have their bodies tended, and went himself, still warm from his armor, to bathe in rather soldierly fashion, with only a single attendant. Before he reached the bathhouse, one of the enemy ran out to face him with a drawn sword, then a second, a third, and several more after them. These men had fled from the battle armed into the bathhouse and had been crouching there in hiding. But when they saw the king, shock overcame them, and they ran past him trembling, though he stood there unarmed, and made for the exits. By chance, none of his other men were present to seize them, and Herod was content simply to have escaped unharmed, so all of them got away. The next day he beheaded Pappus, Antigonus's general, who had already fallen in the battle, and sent the head to his brother Pheroras as payment for their murdered brother, since it was Pappus who had killed Joseph. Once the storm had passed, he marched on Jerusalem, led his force up to the wall. It was now the 3rd year since he had been declared king at Rome, and encamped before the temple, on the side vulnerable to attack, the very side by which Pompey too had earlier taken the city. He divided the army for the labor, cut down the suburbs, and ordered 3 earthworks raised with towers built upon them. Then, leaving the most capable of his companions in charge of the works, he went himself to Samaria to marry the daughter of Alexander, son of Aristobulus, who had already been promised to him, as we mentioned, treating the wedding as a mere incident to the siege, since he already held the enemy in contempt. Having married, he returned to Jerusalem with a larger force. Sosius joined him there with a very large army of cavalry and infantry, which he had sent ahead by the inland route while he himself marched through Phoenicia. Once the whole force was assembled, 11 legions of infantry and 6,000 cavalry, apart from the Syrian allies, who were no small part of it, they encamped near the north wall. Herod relying on the Senate's decrees by which he had been declared king, Sosius relying on Antony, who had sent the army under his command to support Herod. The Jewish population throughout the city was in turmoil of every kind. The weaker element, gathered around the temple, indulged in wild talk more suited to superstition than to the crisis, while the bolder spirits carried out raids of every sort in bands, above all seizing the city's provisions and leaving neither horses nor men any food. The more disciplined part of the fighting men, however, was arrayed for the defense. They kept those building the earthworks away from the wall and constantly devised some new countermeasure against the siege engines. In nothing did they gain the advantage over the enemy so much as in their tunneling. Against their raids, the king devised companies of soldiers to check their sallies, and against the shortage of provisions, supplies brought from a distance. In the fighting itself, the Romans had the advantage through skill and experience, though the defenders left no degree of daring untried. Openly, they clashed with the Romans in the certainty of death, and through tunnels they suddenly appeared in the enemy's midst. Before any part of the wall could be brought down, they had already built another in its place. In short, they spared neither their hands nor their ingenuity, determined to hold out to the last. Despite so great a force besieging them, they held out for 5 months, until some of Herod's picked men, daring to mount the wall, burst into the city, followed by Sosius's centurions. The area around the temple was captured first, and once the army poured in everywhere, there was boundless slaughter. The Romans, enraged by the length of the siege, Herod's Jewish troops determined to leave no rival alive. Great numbers were butchered, crowded together in the alleys, in the houses, and as they fled for refuge to the temple. There was no pity for infants, for old age, or for the weakness of women. Though the king sent word around urging restraint, no one held back his hand, and they went after every age as though possessed. Their Antigonus, giving no thought to either his former or his present fortune, came down from the citadel and threw himself at Sosius's feet. Sosius, showing him no pity in his reversal of fortune, laughed at him without restraint and called him Antigone. Yet he did not release him as one would a woman free of guard, but had him bound and kept under watch. Herod, now master of his enemies, was anxious also to master his foreign allies, for the throng of foreign troops was eager to see the temple and the sacred things within the sanctuary. The king, by persuading some, threatening others, and in some cases restraining them outright, held them back, judging the victory harsher than defeat if anything forbidden should be seen by them. He also put a stop to the plundering throughout the city, protesting strongly to Sosius that if the Romans emptied the city of both money and men and left him king over a desert, he would count so vast a slaughter of citizens a poor exchange even for dominion over the whole world. When Sosius replied that it was only fair to let the soldiers plunder in place of pay for the siege, Herod said he would himself distribute the rewards to each man from his own funds. In this way, he ransomed what remained of his homeland and kept his promises. He rewarded each soldier splendidly, the officers in proportion, and Sosius most royally of all, so that no one went away wanting for money. Sosius, having dedicated a golden crown to God, withdrew from Jerusalem, taking Antigonus in chains to Antony. Antigonus, who had clung to life to the very end on a craven hope, met the death his ignoble spirit deserved by the axe. King Herod, meanwhile, separated out the population of the city. Those who had favored his cause he made more loyal still through honors, while those who had sided with Antigonus he put to death. And since money was now scarce, he had whatever ornaments he owned melted down and sent to Antony and his circle. Yet even this did not buy him complete immunity from harm, for Antony, by now ruined by his passion for Cleopatra, was in every way a slave to his desire. Cleopatra, having worked her way through her own family until none of her blood remained, turned next to murdering outsiders as well, and by slandering the leading men of Syria to Antony induced him to have them put to death, so that she might easily become mistress of each man's property. Extending her greed further still, toward the Jews and the Arabs, she worked to have both people's kings, Herod and Malchus, put to death. Antony, however, coming partly to his senses over these demands, judged it impious to kill men so honorable and kings of such standing, and instead turned away the friends closest to them. Yet he still cut away much of their territory, including the palm grove at Jericho, where balsam is produced, and gave her all the cities within the Eleutherus River except Tyre and Sidon. Once mistress of these lands, and having escorted Antony as far as the Euphrates on his campaign against the Parthians, Cleopatra came to Judea by way of Apamea and Damascus. There Herod appeased her hostility with great gifts, and also leased back the territories cut away from his kingdom for 200 talents a year, and escorted her as far as Pelusium, showing her every courtesy. Not long after, Antony returned from Parthia bringing as a captive Artabazes, son of Tigranes, a gift for Cleopatra. For along with the money and all the plunder, the Parthian prince was handed over to her at once. When the war at Actium broke out, Herod had already prepared to join Antony's expedition, being now free of the other disturbances in Judea and having subdued Hyrcania, a stronghold held by Antigonus's sister. but Cleopatra craftily kept him from sharing in Antony's dangers. For, as we said, plotting against the two kings, she persuaded Antony to entrust to Herod the war against the Arabs, so that whichever side won, if Arabia prevailed or if Judea were defeated, she would become mistress of it, using one ruler to destroy the other. But the scheme turned out to Herod's advantage. First, driving off raiders against the enemy and gathering a large body of cavalry, he sent it against them near Diospolis and won, even though they had put up a stiff resistance. In response to this defeat, a great uprising of the Arabs followed, and, gathering at Kanatha in Seal Syria in numbers beyond count, they waited for the Jews. Herod arrived there with his force and tried to conduct the war more cautiously, ordering a fortified camp to be built. But his men would not obey. Emboldened instead by their earlier victory, they rushed at the Arabs, and when these turned back at the first charge, pursued them. And it was in this pursuit that Herod was ambushed, through the treachery of Athenion, by the local people of Kanatha. He answered the messengers as his grief dictated and turned back toward Egypt. The first evening he lodged at a local shrine, gathering up those who had fallen behind. The next day, as he pressed on toward Rhinocorora, word reached him of his brother's death. Adding mourning to the cares he had just set aside, he pushed forward all the harder. The Arab, repenting though slowly, sent men in haste to recall the man he had wronged, but Herod had already outrun them and reached Pelusium. There, unable to get passage from the ships stationed at anchor, he appealed to their commanders, who, respecting his reputation and rank, sent him on to Alexandria. Entering the city, he was received splendidly by Cleopatra, who hoped to secure him as a general for the campaign she was preparing. But he brushed aside the queen's invitations and, fearing neither the depth of winter nor the turmoil in Italy, sailed for Rome. He ran into danger off Pamphylia, and after throwing most of his cargo overboard, barely made it to Rhodes, a city badly battered by the war with Cassius, where he was received by his friends Ptolemy and Sapinius. Though short of funds, he had a very large trireme built, and in it, together with his friends, sailed to Brundisium and from there hurried on to Rome. There he first sought out Antony, because of the friendship between their fathers, and laid out before him the disasters that had befallen himself and his family. How he had left his closest kin besieged in a fortress and had sailed through winter, a suppliant, to reach him. Antony was moved to pity by this reversal of fortune, and remembering Antipater's hospitality, and above all, recognizing the man's own worth, resolved then and there to make king of the Jews the very man he had earlier made tetrarch. What drove him was no less his quarrel with Antigonus than his regard for Herod, for he took Antigonus to be a rebel and an enemy of Rome. Caesar proved even readier than Antony, recalling Antipater's campaigns alongside his own father in Egypt, his hospitality, his goodwill in every matter, and seeing besides Herod's own energetic character. Antony convened the Senate, where Messala, and after him Atratinus, presented Herod, reviewing the services of his father and his own goodwill toward Rome, and showing at the same time that Antigonus was an enemy, not only for his earlier quarrel with Rome, but because he had now seized power through the Parthians, holding Rome in contempt. When the Senate had been stirred by this, Antony rose and declared that for the sake of the war against Parthia it was in Rome's interest that Herod be king, and all present voted for it. When the session broke up, Antony and Caesar went out with Herod between them, while the consuls and the other magistrates led the way to offer sacrifice and to deposit the decree in the capital. On the first day of Herod's kingship, Antony gave a feast in his honor. During this same time, Antigonus was besieging those holding Masada, who had supplies enough of everything else but were running short of water. So Joseph, Herod's brother, together with 200 of his household, was planning to flee to the Arabs, having heard that Malchus now regretted his offenses against Herod. He would have abandoned the fortress had it not happened, on the very night set for the escape, that a heavy rain fell, the cisterns filled, and the need to flee vanished. Instead, they went out against Antigonus's men, openly engaging some and ambushing others, destroying a good many, though not always with success, for at times they themselves were driven back after a setback. Meanwhile, Ventidius, the Roman general sent from Syria to drive back the Parthians, turned aside into Judea after them, ostensibly to help Joseph's party, but in reality to extort money from Antigonus. Camping close by Jerusalem until he had filled his coffers, he withdrew with the bulk of his force, leaving Silo behind with a portion, so that pulling everyone out at once would not expose the bribery. Antigonus, still hoping the Parthians would come to his aid, courted Silo for the time being, so that he would cause no trouble before that hope was tested. By now Herod had sailed from Italy to Ptolemais, and having gathered no small force of foreign and native troops, was marching through Galilee against Antigonus, with Ventidius and Silo cooperating, for Dellius, sent by Antony, had persuaded them to help bring Herod home. Ventidius happened to be occupied settling the disturbances the Parthians had caused in the cities, while Silo remained in Judea, bribed by Antigonus. Herod, however, was not short of strength. As he advanced, his forces grew day by day, and all of Galilee but for a few joined him. His most urgent task lay ahead, relieving Masada and rescuing his kin from the siege there. But Joppa stood in his way, and being hostile had to be taken first, so that no enemy stronghold would remain at his back once he advanced on Jerusalem. Silo gladly joined him in this, glad of a pretext to withdraw, and was pursued by the Jews as he did so. Herod, sallying out against them with a small band, quickly routed them and rescued Silo, who was defending himself poorly. Then, having taken Joppa, he hurried on to Masada to rescue his kin. Of the local people, some were drawn to him by their father's friendship, others by his own renown, others by gratitude for benefits received from both him and his father, but the greatest number by hope, as toward a king already secure in his throne, and so a force not easily shaken had gathered. As he advanced, Antigonus set ambushes for him, blocking the useful passes, though these did the enemy little or no harm. Herod, having taken up his kin from Masada, easily took also the fortress of Ressa and marched on Jerusalem. Silo's troops joined him there, along with many from the city, terrified by his strength. When they had camped on the western side of the city, the guards posted their shot arrows and hurled javelins at them, while others sallied out in bands to test the strength of the front ranks. Herod at first ordered a proclamation made around the wall, that he had come for the people's good and the city's safety, that he would not take revenge even on his open enemies, and that he would grant amnesty even to his bitterest opponents. But when Antigonus's men shouted him down, allowing no one to hear the proclamations or change sides, he thereafter permitted his own men to strike back at those on the wall, and they quickly drove everyone from the towers with their missiles. It was then that Silo's bribery came out into the open. He had stirred up a great many of the soldiers to cry out over a shortage of supplies and demand money for provisions, and to press for withdrawing to winter quarters in their own territory, on the grounds that the country around the city had been stripped bare, Antigonus's men having cleared it out in advance. He broke camp and tried to withdraw. Herod, meeting with Silo's officers and with the rank and file in a body, begged them not to abandon him, sent as he was by Caesar, Antony, and the Senate. He would, he said, resolve their shortages that very day. And after this appeal, he set out at once into the countryside and brought back so great an abundance of provisions that he cut away every pretext of Silo's. Taking thought also that the supply not fail in the days that followed, he wrote to the people around Samaria, a city on friendly terms with him, to bring down grain, wine, oil, and cattle to Jericho. When Antigonus heard of this, he sent men throughout the countryside with orders to block the roads and ambush the grain convoys. They obeyed, and a great number of armed men gathered beyond Jericho, taking up positions on the hills to watch for those bringing in the supplies. Herod, however, would not rest. Taking 10 cohorts, of which 5 were Roman and 5 Jewish, along with some mixed mercenaries and a few cavalry, he came to Jericho and found the city itself abandoned, but 500 men holding the heights together with their wives and children. These he released once he had taken them, while the Romans burst into the rest of the town and plundered it, finding the houses full of every kind of valuable. The king then left a garrison at Jericho and turned back, dispersing the Roman army for the winter among Idumea, Galilee, and Samaria, all now on his side. Antigonus, for his part, also managed, through Silo's venality, to have a portion of the army quartered at Lydda, as a courtesy to Antony. While the Romans lived in plenty with their arms laid aside, Herod did not rest. He secured Idumea with 2,000 infantry and 400 cavalry, sending his brother Joseph there so that nothing might turn toward Antigonus in his absence, while he himself brought his mother and all the kin he had brought out of Masada to Samaria, and having settled them there safely, went on to subdue the rest of Galilee and drive out Antigonus's garrisons. Marching on Sepphoris through a violent snowstorm, he took the city without a blow, its guards having fled before he even arrived. There he took up those of his men who had suffered from the storm, supplies were abundant, and then set out against the brigands living in the caves, who were ravaging much of the country and inflicting on the local people evils no less than those of war. Sending ahead 3 infantry regiments and 1 cavalry squadron to the village of Arbela, he himself came up after 40 days with the rest of his force. The enemy were not frightened by his approach, but met him in arms, having the experience of soldiers along with the daring of brigands. Engaging his men, they drove back the left wing of Herod's line with their own right. But Herod, quickly wheeling around from his own right wing, came to the rescue, turned back his own men from their flight, and falling upon the pursuers, checked their advance until, unable to bear the assault head-on, they turned aside. He pursued them, killing as far as the Jordan, destroying a great part of them. The rest scattered beyond the river, so that Galilee was cleared of danger except for those still lurking in the caves, and dealing with these required time. So first, he paid his soldiers the fruits of their labors, distributing 150 silver drachmas to each man and far more to the officers, sending it to them at the quarters where they were wintering. He instructed Pheroras, the youngest of his brothers, to see to their supplies and to fortify Alexandrium, and Pheroras attended to both tasks. Meanwhile, Antony was spending his time around Athens, and Ventidius, preparing for the war against the Parthians, summoned Silo and Herod, writing first that affairs in Judea should be settled beforehand. Herod, glad to be rid of him, released Silo to join Ventidius, and himself campaigned against the men in the caves. These caves lay against sheer cliffs, approachable from no direction except by narrow, oblique paths. The rock facing them dropped away into very deep ravines, plunging steeply down to the gorges, so that the king for a long time was at a loss before the impossibility of the place, until at last he resorted to a most hazardous device. Lowering his strongest men in chests, he had them let down to the mouths of the caves. There they slaughtered the occupants along with their families and threw fire in upon those who resisted. Wishing to spare some of them, Herod had it proclaimed that they should come out to him. Not one came voluntarily, and of those taken by force, many chose death over captivity. There one old man, father of 7 children, when his sons and their mother begged to be allowed to come out under a pledge of safety, killed them instead in this manner. Ordering them to come forward one at a time, he himself stood at the mouth of the cave and cut down each son as he stepped forward. Herod, watching from a distance, was seized with pity and stretched out his hand to the old man, begging him to spare his children. But the man, yielding to none of it and even reproaching Herod for his baseness, killed the children and then the wife as well, and, throwing the bodies down the cliff, at last threw himself down after them. In this way, Herod subdued the caves and those within them, leaving behind as much of his army as he judged sufficient to guard against uprisings. With Ptolemy in command, he turned back toward Samaria, taking 3,000 infantry and 600 cavalry with him against Antigonus. But no sooner had he withdrawn than those accustomed to stir up trouble in Galilee, seizing their chance, fell suddenly upon Ptolemy the commander and killed him, and went on to ravage the countryside, taking refuge in the marshes and other places hard to search out. When Herod learned of the uprising, he hurried to the rescue, destroyed a great number of them, and, reducing all their strongholds by siege, exacted from the cities, as the penalty for their defection, 100 talents. Now that the Parthians had been driven out and Pacorus killed, Ventidius, on Antony's instructions, sent Herod 1,000 cavalry and 2 legions as reinforcements against Antigonus. Antigonus, by letters, begged their commander Machaerus to come and help him instead, complaining bitterly of Herod's violence and promising money. Machaerus did not slight the man who had sent for him, especially since he was offering more than Herod, yet he did not go over to the betrayal. Instead, feigning friendship, he went to spy out Antigonus's position, ignoring Herod's efforts to dissuade him. Antigonus, sensing his intent beforehand, shut the city against him and defended the walls as against an enemy, until Machaerus, ashamed, withdrew to Emmaus to join Herod. Furious at the rebuff, he killed every Jew he came across, sparing none of Herod's own men either, treating them all as though they belonged to Antigonus. Angered at this, Herod set out to retaliate against Machaerus as an enemy, but mastering his rage, rode instead to Antony to accuse Machaerus of his lawless conduct. Antony, on reflection, recognized the wrongs that had been done and quickly pursued the king, and after much entreaty was reconciled with him. Even so, Herod did not slacken his drive toward Antony. Hearing that he was pressing the siege of Samosata with a large force, a strong city near the Euphrates, he hurried there all the faster, seeing the moment fit both for a display of courage and for winning Antony's favor still further. Arriving, he brought the siege to its conclusion, killing many of the barbarians and carrying off a great deal of plunder, so that Antony, who had long admired his valor, now held him in even higher regard than before, and added a great deal more to the honors he had already given him. To the other honors, he showed him and to his hopes for the kingship, and forced King Antiochus to surrender Samosata. Meanwhile, Herod's affairs in Judea were falling apart. He had left his brother Joseph in charge of everything, with orders to undertake nothing against Antigonus until his return, since Machaerus could not be trusted as an ally after what he had done. But when Joseph heard that his brother was very far away, he ignored these instructions and marched on Jericho with 5 cohorts that Machaerus had sent along, intending to seize the grain at the height of the harvest. The enemy fell upon him in the mountains and rough terrain. He himself died, showing great courage in the battle, and the entire Roman force was destroyed. The cohorts were newly levied men from Syria, and none of the so-called veterans had been mixed in among them who could have supported troops inexperienced in war. The victory was not enough for Antigonus. His rage went so far that he even mutilated Joseph's corpse. Once he had the bodies in his power, he cut off Joseph's head, even though Pharaoh's his brother offered 50 talents as ransom for it. After the victory of Antigonus, Galilee was thrown into such upheaval that the partisans of Herod among the leading men were seized by Antigonus's supporters and drowned in the lake. Much of Idumea also changed sides, where Machaerus was fortifying a stronghold called Gitta. Herod had not yet learned of any of this. After the capture of Samosata, Antony had set Sosius over Syria and ordered him to help Herod against Antigonus, and had himself withdrawn to Egypt. Sosius sent ahead 2 legions into Judea to reinforce Herod, and himself followed close behind with the rest of the army. While Herod was at Daphne near Antioch, clear dreams foretold his brother's death, and he leapt from his bed in distress, just as messengers came in with news of the disaster. He gave brief vent to grief over the misfortune, but put off the greater part of his mourning and pressed on against the enemy, forcing the march beyond his strength. Reaching Lebanon, he took on 800 of the mountain people as allies and joined with them 1 Roman legion. With these, he did not wait even a day but invaded Galilee, and the enemy who came out to meet him were driven back to the position they had earlier abandoned. He kept up a steady assault on the fortress, but before he could take it, he was forced by a very severe storm to encamp in the neighboring villages. When a few days later the 2nd legion from Antony joined him as well, the enemy, fearing his strength, abandoned the stronghold by night. From there, he pressed on through Jericho, hurrying to overtake his brother's murderers as quickly as possible. There a strange and providential thing happened to him, from which, having been unexpectedly saved, he gained a reputation as a man especially favored by God. Many of the leading men had dined with him that evening, and after the banquet broke up and everyone had left, the house immediately collapsed. Judging this a sign common to both the dangers and the deliverance of the coming war, he roused the army before dawn. About 6,000 of the enemy came running down from the hills to test his front ranks. Not daring to close with the Romans hand to hand, they hurled stones and javelins from a distance and wounded many. In this skirmish, Herod himself, riding along the line, was struck in the side by a javelin. Antigonus, wanting to prevail not only in daring but in numbers, sent a certain Pappus, one of his companions, with an army around toward Samaria. Machaerus became this man's opponent, while Herod overran the enemy's territory, destroyed 5 small towns, killed 2,000 of their inhabitants, burned the houses, and returned to camp. he had bivouacked near the village called Cana. Every day a great crowd of Jews came over to him from Jericho itself, and from the rest of the country, some out of hatred for Antigonus, others stirred by his own successes, but the majority driven by nothing more than a senseless craving for change. Herod was eager to give battle, and Pappus and his men, undaunted by either the numbers or the ardor of his forces, came out boldly to meet him. When the lines engaged, the rest of the enemy's units held out for only a short while. But Herod, fighting recklessly in memory of his murdered brother in order to punish those responsible for the killing, quickly overcame the troops facing him, and then, turning always against whatever body still held together, routed them all. The slaughter was great. Some were driven back together into the village they had set out from, while Herod pressed hard on the rearmost, killing without number. He burst into the village along with the fleeing enemy. Every house was packed with armed men, and the roofs above were crowded with defenders. Once he had overcome those outside, he tore apart the buildings and dragged out those within. On many, he brought the roofs down all at once, crushing them in heaps, while his soldiers with drawn swords caught those who tried to escape from the wreckage. So great a mass of dead piled up that the roads were blocked even to the victors. The enemy could not bear this blow. As soon as the survivors gathering together saw their comrades throughout the village destroyed, they scattered in flight, and Herod, emboldened at once by the victory, would have marched straight on Jerusalem had he not been checked by a most violent storm. This alone stood in the way both of his complete success and, for Antigonus, of a defeat that would have made him abandon the city already. Toward evening, Herod dismissed his friends, worn out, to attend to their bodies, and he himself, still hot from his armor, went off to bathe in soldierly fashion with only one servant attending him. Before he reached the bathhouse, one of the enemy ran out toward him with a drawn sword, then a second, a third, and several more after them. These men had fled from the battle into the bathhouse still armed and had been crouching there in hiding. But when they caught sight of the king, panic overcame them, and they ran past him, naked and trembling as he was, making for the exits. No one else happened to be present to seize the men, and Herod was satisfied simply to have come to no harm, so all of them got away. The next day he beheaded Pappus, Antigonus's general, who had fallen in the battle, and sent the head to his brother Pheroras as payment for their murdered brother, since it was this man who had killed Joseph. When the storm subsided, he marched on Jerusalem and brought his army up to the wall. It was now the third year since he had been declared king at Rome. He encamped before the temple, since that side was open to attack, the very point where Pompey too had earlier taken the city. He divided the army for the work, and after clearing the suburbs, he ordered three earthworks raised and towers built upon them, and leaving the most capable of his companions in charge of the works, he himself went to Samaria to marry Alexander's daughter, granddaughter of Aristobulus, who had been betrothed to him, as we mentioned, treating the wedding as a mere incident to the siege, since he already held the enemy in contempt. Having married, he returned to Jerusalem with a larger force. Sosius, too, joined him with a very large army of both cavalry and infantry, which he had sent on ahead through the interior while he himself marched through Phoenicia. When the whole force was assembled, 11 legions of infantry and 6,000 cavalry, besides the Syrian allies, who were no small part of it, they encamped near the north wall, Herod relying on the decree of the Senate by which he had been declared king, Sosius acting as ally to Herod on behalf of Antony, who had sent the army under his command. The mass of the Jews throughout the city was thrown into various kinds of confusion. The weaker sort, gathering around the temple, spun out prophecies filled with superstition and wishful thinking suited to the crisis, while among the bolder men there were bands of raiders of every sort, who above all plundered the supplies around the city and left neither horses nor men any food. But the better disciplined part of the fighting force was posted to defend against the siege. They kept those building the earthworks away from the wall and forever devised some new countermeasure against the siege engines. In nothing did they have the advantage over the enemy so much as in mining. Against the raiders, the king devised ambush parties by which he checked their sallies, and against the shortage of supplies, convoys brought from a distance. But in the actual fighting, the Romans had the advantage through their skill, though the defenders left no degree of daring untried. Openly, they threw themselves upon the Romans in the face of certain death, and through the mine tunnels, they suddenly appeared in the enemy's very midst, and before any part of the wall had been battered down, they had already built another behind it. In short, they were tireless in hand and in ingenuity, resolved to hold out to the very end. Indeed, against so great a force laying siege, they kept up the resistance for 5 months, until some of Herod's picked men, daring to mount the wall, broke into the city, followed by Sosius's centurions. First, the area around the temple was taken, and once the army poured in everywhere, there was slaughter without measure. The Romans enraged by the length of the siege, and Herod's Jewish troops determined to leave not one of their opponents alive. They were butchered in droves, crowded together in the alleys and in the houses, and as they fled for refuge to the temple, there was no pity for infants, none for old age, none for the weakness of women. Though the king sent men around begging that they be spared, no one held back his hand, but as if possessed they cut down every age alike. It was then that Antigonus, giving no thought to his past or present fortune, came down from the citadel and fell at Sosius's feet. But Sosius, showing him no pity in his change of fortune, laughed at him without restraint and called him Antigone, as if he were a woman. Yet he did not let him go free as a woman would be, but had him bound and kept under guard. Once he had mastered his enemies, Herod's next concern was to master his foreign allies as well, for the mass of foreign troops was eager to view the temple and the sacred things within the sanctuary. The king, by persuading some and threatening others, and restraining a few even by force, held them back, judging the victory harsher than defeat if anything forbidden to be seen were exposed by them. He also put a stop by now to the plundering of the city, protesting strongly to Sosius that if the Romans left him king of an emptied city, stripped of both money and men, they would be valuing the rule of the whole world too cheaply against the killing of so many citizens. When Sosius replied that it was only just to allow the soldiers the plunder in place of the siege pay, Herod said he himself would distribute the wages to each man from his own funds. In this way, having ransomed the rest of his native city, he fulfilled his promises. He rewarded each soldier splendidly, the officers in proportion, and Sosius most royally of all, so that no one went away wanting for money. Sosius, after dedicating a golden crown to God, withdrew from Jerusalem, taking Antigonus in chains to Antony. This man, who had clung to life to the last out of a cold hope, met the axe he deserved for his cowardice. King Herod, meanwhile, sorted out the population of the city, showing greater favor and honor to those who had supported him and putting to death the partisans of Antigonus. And now, being short of funds, he sent to Antony and his circle all the gold ornaments he had, converted into coin. Even this did not buy him complete immunity from harm, for Antony, by now corrupted by his passion for Cleopatra, was in all things a slave to his desire. While Cleopatra, having worked her way through her own family, so that not one of her blood relations was left, now turned her murderous designs on outsiders, and by slandering the leading men of Syria to Antony, persuaded him to have them put to death, so that she might easily become mistress of each man's property. Extending her greed further, to the Jews and the Arabs, she worked to have Herod and Malchus, the kings of the two peoples, put to death. In the matter of these orders, however, Antony came partly to his senses. He judged it impious to kill men so good and kings of such standing, but he did break off his friendship with those closest to them. He cut away a good deal of their territory, including the palm grove at Jericho, where the balsam is produced, and gave it to Cleopatra, along with all the cities within the Eleutherus River, except Tyre and Sidon. Once mistress of these, she escorted Antony as far as the Euphrates on his campaign against the Parthians, and then came to Judea by way of Apamea and Damascus. There Herod won over her ill will with lavish gifts, and also leased back the territories cut away from his kingdom for 200 talents a year, and escorted her as far as Pelusium, showing her every attention. Not long after, Antony returned from the Parthian campaign bringing as a captive Artabazus, son of Tigranes, a gift for Cleopatra. For along with the money and all the plunder, the Parthian prince himself was straightway given to her. When the war at Actium had broken out, Herod was already preparing to set out with Antony, having by now freed himself from the other disturbances in Judea and having gained control of Hyrcania, a stronghold held by Antigonus's sister. but he was cunningly kept by Cleopatra from sharing in Antony's dangers. For, as we said, plotting against the kings, she persuaded Antony to entrust the war against the Arabs to Herod, so that whichever man prevailed, whether he conquered Arabia or was conquered and lost Judea, she might become mistress and use the one ruler to bring down the other. The scheme, however, tipped in Herod's favor. First, driving off cattle from the enemy and gathering a large body of cavalry, he launched it against them near Diospolis and was victorious, even though they resisted stoutly. In response to this defeat, a great uprising of the Arabs arose, and gathering at Kanatha in Celesyria in countless numbers, they waited for the Jews. There Herod came up with his army and tried to conduct the war more cautiously, ordering a fortified camp to be built. But the army would not obey. Emboldened by their earlier victory, they rushed upon the Arabs, and when the enemy broke at the first onset, they pursued them. But in the pursuit, Herod was ambushed, Athenian having let loose against him the local people of Kanatha. This man had always been at odds with Herod among Cleopatra's generals. Under this attack, the Arabs took heart and turned to face the Jews again, massing their forces amid rocky, impassable ground. They routed Herod's men and inflicted very heavy losses. The survivors of the battle fled to Ormuzdah, where the Arabs surrounded their camp as well and captured it, men and all. Not long after, Herod arrived with reinforcements, too late to be of use. The blame for this blow fell on the insubordination of his officers, for if the engagement had not broken out unexpectedly, Athenian would never have found the occasion for his trap. Herod nevertheless took his revenge on the Arabs, overrunning their country again and again, until he had recovered his single lost victory many times over. But while he was still punishing his enemies, another calamity struck him, one that seemed to come from heaven. In the seventh year of his reign, at the height of the war at Actium, at the beginning of spring, the earth was shaken and destroyed countless numbers of cattle and 30,000 people, though the army escaped unharmed, since it was camped in the open. In the midst of this, the Arabs were emboldened to still greater insolence by rumor, which has always added something still worse to the gloom already there. Believing all Judea leveled and the land empty for the taking, they set out against it, first sacrificing the envoys who had come to them from the Jews. The people, terrified by this invasion and worn down by the weight of one disaster following another, lost heart, and Herod gathered them together and tried to rouse them to defend themselves with a speech of this kind. "It seems to me quite unreasonable that the present fear should be taking hold of you." Being disheartened at the blows that came from heaven was understandable enough, but to feel the same way before a human attack is a mark of cowardice. "I myself am so far from cringing before the enemy after the earthquake that I take it the God has set this very thing before the Arabs as bait, to bring them to justice. For they have come relying not so much on weapons or their own hands as on the misfortunes that struck us by chance, and hope resting on another's misery rather than one's own strength is a shaky thing. Neither ill fortune nor its opposite is stable among men. One can see fortune shifting to both sides in turn. You can learn this from your own experience. In the earlier battle, though we had the upper hand, the enemy defeated us, and it is likely that now, when they think they are sure to win, they will be caught, for overconfidence goes unguarded, while fear teaches foresight. So it is precisely your present dread that gives me grounds for confidence. When you grew bolder than was wise and rushed out against the enemy against my judgment, that was when Athenian's ambush found its opportunity. But now your hesitation, and what looks like faint-heartedness, is my guarantee of victory. Still, this frame of mind should hold only until the moment we advance. Once in action, you must rouse your spirits and convince the most godless of men that no evil, whether from men or from heaven, will ever bring down the courage of the Jews, so long as they keep their resolve, and that no one will stand by and watch an Arab become master of another man's goods, when he has time and again all but fallen into that man's hands as a captive. And do not let the tremors of lifeless matter unsettle you, nor take the earthquake as a sign portending some further disaster. Such disturbances of the elements are natural, and bring men no harm beyond the damage they do in themselves. Of plague, famine, and tremors of the earth, some small warning sign might come beforehand, but these very things have a limit to their scale. What greater harm, after all, could the earthquake do to us than a war, once it has gained the upper hand. But the greatest portent of the enemy's coming destruction has come about not by accident nor at another's hand. They have put our envoys to death in brutal violation of the law common to all mankind, and have crowned the war with such offerings to God. They will not escape his great eye and his unconquerable right hand. They will pay us the penalty at once, if only we now summon up the spirit of our fathers and rise as avengers of the men who were murdered in violation of the truce. Let each man go forth, not for wife, not for children, not for a homeland in danger, but in defense of the envoys. The dead will command this war better than the living. And I myself will risk danger before you, if you follow me obediently. For be assured, your own courage is irresistible, unless some rashness does you harm. With this speech he roused his army, and when he saw them eager for battle, he offered sacrifice to God, and after the sacrifice crossed the river Jordan with his forces. Encamping near Philadelphia, close to the enemy, he skirmished with them over a fort that lay between the two camps, wanting to bring on a battle quickly. For the Arabs too had already sent some men ahead to seize the stronghold. These the king's men quickly drove back and took the hill, while Herod himself led his forces out day after day and drew them up for battle, challenging the Arabs to fight. But no one came out against him, for a terrible panic gripped them, and even their general Elthemis stood rigid with fear before the eyes of his own troops. At last, driven on by necessity, they came out to battle, disorganized, infantry and cavalry mixed in confusion. In numbers the Jews were outmatched, but they were far superior in eagerness, though the Arabs too fought recklessly out of despair of victory. So as long as they held their ground the slaughter among them was not great, but once they showed their backs, many were destroyed by the Jews and many more trampled by their own comrades. 5,000 fell in the rout, and the rest of the mass just managed to crowd into the camp. Herod surrounded and besieged them, and as they were about to be overcome by force, thirst, brought on by the failure of their water supply, pressed them even harder. The king scorned their attempts to negotiate, and even when they offered 500 talents as ransom, pressed the siege all the harder. As their thirst grew unbearable, they came out in crowds and surrendered themselves to the Jews of their own accord, so that in 5 days 4,000 were taken prisoner, and on the sixth the remaining mass, driven by despair, came out to fight. Herod engaged them and killed about 7,000 more. Having thus punished Arabia with so heavy a blow and crushed the spirit of its men, he rose so far in standing that the nation chose him as its protector. But at once the concern for the whole state of affairs took hold of him again, because of his friendship with Antony, now that Caesar had won at Actium. Yet he had more to fear from the appearance of the thing than he actually suffered, for Caesar did not consider Antony truly beaten while Herod still stood by him. The king, for his part, resolved to face the danger head-on. Sailing to Rhodes, where Caesar was staying, he came before him without his diadem, in dress and bearing a private citizen, but in spirit a king. Holding back nothing of the truth, he spoke to him directly. "I, Caesar, was made king by Antony, and I admit that in everything I proved myself useful to Antony. Nor would I hold back from saying this too. You would certainly have found me a grateful ally with my arms as well, had the Arabs not prevented it. I sent him what help I could, and many thousands of measures of grain besides, and even after the disaster at Actium, I did not abandon my benefactor, but became his best counselor. Once I was no longer of use to him as an ally, telling him that the one remedy for his failures was the death of Cleopatra. Had he put her to death, I promised him money, walls for security, an army, and myself as a partner in the war against you. But it seems his ears were stopped up by his longing for Cleopatra, and by the God who is granting the victory to you. I have fallen together with Antony, and I have laid down my diadem along with his fortune. I have come to you holding to virtue as my hope of safety, believing that you would first want to examine what kind of friend I was, not whose friend. To this Caesar replied, "No, be safe, and rule now on firmer ground than before, for you deserve to govern a great many, holding to your friendships as steadfastly as this. Try to remain just as faithful to me, now that fortune has favored me more. For my part, I have the highest hopes for a man of your spirit. Antony, though, did well to be persuaded by Cleopatra rather than by you, for through his folly we have gained you. It seems, moreover, you are already beginning to do me good service, to judge by what Ventidius writes me, that you have sent him aid against the gladiators. For now, then, I declare by decree that your kingdom is secure. And I shall try in the future to do you further good, so that you will not miss Antony. With these kind words to the king, he set the diadem back on his head and made known this gift by public decree, in which he spoke at length and generously in the man's praise. Herod, having won him over further with gifts, begged from him the life of Alexas, one of Antony's friends who had become his suppliant. But Caesar's anger prevailed, since he had many harsh complaints against the man he was asked to spare, and so he refused the request. Afterward, when Caesar was traveling to Egypt through Syria, Herod received him with all his royal wealth and rode out with him for the first time as Caesar reviewed his forces near Ptolemais and feasted him together with all his friends. After them, he distributed provisions for a banquet to the rest of the army as well. He also took care to supply plentiful water for those marching through the waterless country as far as Pelusium, and the same again on the return, so that the army lacked for nothing it needed. Indeed, it struck both Caesar and his soldiers that the kingdom left to Herod was far too small a reward for what he had provided. For this reason, when Caesar reached Egypt, now that Cleopatra and Antony were both dead, he not only heaped further honors on Herod, but added to his kingdom the territory that Cleopatra had cut away from it. And besides this, from outside, Gadara, Hippos, and Samaria, and along the coast, Gaza, Anthedon, Joppa, and Strato's Tower. He also gave him 400 Galatians as a bodyguard, who had formerly served Cleopatra as spearmen. Nothing spurred Caesar on to such gifts so much as the greatness of spirit shown by the man who received them. After the first Axiad, he added to Herod's kingdom the district called Trachonitis and the neighboring Batania and Oronitis for the following reason. Zenodorus, who had leased the estate of Lysanias, did not stop letting loose the bandits of Trachonitis on the people of Damascus. They fled to Varro, the governor of Syria, and begged him to report their disaster to Caesar, and Caesar, on learning of it, sent back orders that the band of robbers be wiped out. Varro accordingly took the field, cleared the land of the men, and took it away from Zenodorus. Caesar later gave this territory to Herod, so that it would not again become a base for bandits threatening Damascus. He also made him procurator of the whole of Syria when he returned to the province 10 years later, so that nothing could be done by the other procurators without his advice. And when Zenodorus died, he assigned to Herod as well the whole territory between Trachonitis and Galilee. But what mattered more to Herod than all this was that he was loved by Caesar second only to Agrippa, and by Agrippa second only to Caesar. From this point, he advanced to the height of prosperity. His spirit rose to greater things, and the greater part of that ambitious spirit he turned toward acts of piety. Thus, in the 15th year of his reign, he rebuilt the temple itself and enclosed a precinct around it twice the size of the former one, sparing no expense and matching it with unsurpassed magnificence. Proof of this could be seen in the great colonnades around the sanctuary and the fortress on its north side. The colonnades he built up from their foundations, while the fortress, which he refurbished with lavish wealth, he named Antonia in Antony's honor, making it in no way inferior to a royal palace. His own palace, which he built in the upper city, contained two very large and beautiful wings, with which not even the temple could be compared. These he named, after his friends, the Caesarum and the Agrippium. Nor did he confine their memory and their names to buildings alone. His ambition to honor them spread to whole cities. In the territory of Samaria, he built a city with a very fine wall 20 stadia in circuit, settled 6,000 people there, gave them the richest land, and in the middle of the new city, founded a very great temple with a sacred precinct around it, 3.5 stadia across dedicated to Caesar, and named the town Sebaste. He also granted its inhabitants a special constitution. Since Caesar further rewarded him with the grant of additional territory, Herod thereto founded him a temple of white marble near the springs of the Jordan. The place is called Panium. There a mountain peak rises to an immense height, and at the foot of the cliff, a shaded cave opens up, through which a chasm plunges down to an unfathomable depth, filled with still water so deep that no line let down to explore the bottom of the earth has ever proved long enough. Outside the cave, at the base of the rock, the springs rise up, and this, as some think, is the true source of the Jordan, though we will explain the precise truth of the matter later. The king also built other structures at Jericho, between the fortress of Sipros and the former palaces, finer and more useful for visits, and named them after the same friends. In short, there was no site anywhere suitable in his kingdom that he left without some mark of honor to Caesar. And once he had filled his own country with temples, he poured his honors out over the province as well, founding a Caesarea in many cities. Noticing, too, a city on the coast that was already in decline, called Strato's Tower, he saw that the natural advantages of the site could match his ambition, and rebuilt the whole of it in white stone, adorning it with the most splendid palaces. Here above all he displayed the greatness of his natural genius, for between Dor and Joppa, midway between which the city lies, the entire coast lacks a harbor, so that everyone sailing along Phoenicia toward Egypt must ride at anchor out at sea because of the threat from the southwest wind, which even at a moderate blow raises so great a swell against the rocks that the backwash of the waves churns the sea into fury far and wide. But the king, overcoming nature by his outlay and his ambition, built a harbor larger than Piraeus, and within its recesses other deep anchorages besides. Since the whole site worked against him, he fought the difficulty to a standstill, so that the strength of the construction proved unconquerable by the sea, while its beauty was adorned as though no difficulty stood in the way at all, for having measured out the size we have described. He let down stones 20 fathoms into the sea to form the harbor's breakwater, most of them 50 feet long, 9 feet deep, and 10 feet wide, some even larger. Once the submerged foundation had been filled in, the wall rising above the water was widened to 200 feet. Of this, 100 feet had been built out first to break the force of the waves, hence it was called the breakwater, and the rest supports the stone wall running around the harbor. This wall is broken up by very large towers, the finest and most prominent of which, named after Caesar's stepson, is called the Drusian. Frequent vaulted chambers receive those putting into anchor, and the whole area in front of them forms a broad walkway, circling round, for passengers landing. The entrance faces north, since the north wind is the calmest at that place, and at the mouth of the harbor stand three colossal statues on each side, resting on columns. On the left, as one sails in a solid tower, holds them up, while on the right two upright stones stand joined together, larger than the tower on the opposite side. Houses of white stone adjoin the harbor as well, and the streets of the city run down to it, laid out at equal intervals.